stood in the middle of the room after he had left, and wondered why she suddenly felt empty and cold, why she hadn't known until this moment that she had hoped he would force her to follow him. Then she shrugged and smiled reproachfully at herself, and went back to the work on her desk. Chapter 13. On a day in October, when the Heller house was nearing completion, a lanky young man in overalls stepped out of a small group that stood watching the house from the road and approached Rourke. "You're the fellow who built the booby hatch?" he asked, quite diffidently.
"If you mean this house, yes," Rourke answered.
"Oh, I beg your pardon, sir. It's only that that's what they call the place around here. It's not what I'd call it. You see, I've got a building job. Well, not exactly, but I'm going to build a filling station of my own about 10 miles from here down on the post road. I'd like to talk to you."
Later, on a bench in front of the garage where he worked, Jimmy Gowan explained in detail. He added,
"And how I happen to think of you, Mr. Rourke, is that I like it, that funny house of yours. Can't say why, but I like it. It makes sense to me. And then again, I figured everybody's gaping at it and talking about it. Well, that's no use to a house, but that'd be plenty smart for a business. Let them giggle, but let them talk about it. So I thought I'd get you to build it, and then they'll all say I'm crazy, but do you care? I don't."
Jimmy Gowan had worked like a mule for 15 years, saving money for a business of his own. People voiced indignant objections to his choice of architect. Jimmy uttered no word of explanation or self-defense. He said politely, "Maybe so, folks, maybe so," and proceeded to have Rourke build his station. The station opened on a day in late December. It stood on the edge of the Boston Post Road, two small structures of glass and concrete forming a semicircle among the trees. The cylinder of the office and the long, low oval of the diner, with the gasoline pumps as the colonnade of a forecourt between them. It was a study in circles. There were no angles and no straight lines. It looked like shapes caught in a flow, held still at the moment of being poured, at the precise moment when they formed a harmony that seemed too perfect to be intentional. It looked like a cluster of bubbles hanging low over the ground, not quite touching it, to be swept aside in an instant on a wind of speed. It looked gay, with the hard, bracing gaiety of efficiency, like a powerful airplane engine. Rourke stayed at the station on the day of its opening. He drank coffee in a clean white mug at the counter of the diner, and he watched the cars stopping at the door. He left late at night. He looked back once, driving down the long, empty road. The lights of the station winked, flowing away from him. There it stood at the crossing of two roads, and cars would be streaming past it day and night, cars coming from cities in which there was no room for buildings such as this, going to cities in which there would be no buildings such as this. He turned his face to the road before him, and he kept his eyes off the mirror, which still held, glittering softly, dots of light that moved away far behind him. He drove back to months of idleness. He sat in his office each morning because he knew that he had to sit there, looking at a door that never opened, his fingers forgotten on a telephone that never rang. The ashtrays he emptied each day before leaving contained nothing but the stubs of his own cigarettes. "What are you doing about it, Howard?" Austin Heller asked him at dinner one evening.
"Nothing."
"But you must."
"There's nothing I can do."
"You must learn how to handle people."
"I can't."
"Why?"
"I don't know how. I was born without some one particular sense.
It's something one acquires.
I have no organ to acquire it with. I don't know whether it's something I lack or something extra I have that stops me. Besides, I don't like people who have to be handled."
"But you can't sit still and do nothing now. You've got to go after commissions."
"What can I tell people in order to get commissions? I can only show my work. If they don't hear that, they won't hear anything I say. I'm nothing to them. But my work is all we have in common, and I have no desire to tell them anything else."
"Then what are you going to do? You're not worried?"
"No, I expected it. I'm waiting."
"For what?"
"My kind of people."
"What kind is that?"
"I don't know. Yes, I do. But I can't explain it. I've often wished I could. There must be some one principle to cover it, but I don't know what it is."
"Honesty?"
Yes. No, only partly. Guy Francone is an honest man, but it isn't that.
Courage? Ralston Holcomb has courage, in his own manner.
I don't know. I'm not that vague on other things, but I can tell my kind of people by their faces, by something in their faces. There will be thousands passing by your house and by the gas station, if out of those thousands one stops and sees it.
That's all I need.
Then you do need other people after all, don't you, Howard?
Of course. What are you laughing at? I've always thought that you were the most antisocial animal I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. I need people to give me work. I'm not building mausoleums. Do you suppose I should need them in some other way? In a closer, more personal way?
You don't need anyone in a very personal way.
No.
You're not even boasting about it.
Should I?
You can't. You're too arrogant to boast.
Is that what I am?
Don't you know what you are?
No. Not as far as you're seeing me, or anyone else.
Heller sat silently, his wrist describing circles with a cigarette. Then Heller laughed and said,
"That was typical."
"What?"
"That you didn't ask me to tell you what you are as I see you. Anybody else would have."
"I'm sorry. It wasn't indifference. You're one of the few friends I want to keep. I just didn't think of asking."
"I know you didn't. That's the point. You're a self-centered monster, Howard. The more monstrous, because you're utterly innocent about it."
"That's true."
"You should show a little concern when you admit that."
"Why?"
"You know, there's a thing that stumps me.
You're the coldest man I know, and I can't understand why, knowing that you're actually a fiend in your quiet sort of way. Why, I always feel, when I see you, that you're the most life-giving person I've ever met."
"What do you mean?"
"I don't know.
Just that."
The weeks went by, and Rourke walked to his office each day, sat at his desk for 8 hours, and read a great deal. At 5 o'clock he walked home. He had moved to a better room near the office. He spent little. He had enough money for a long time to come. On a morning in February, the telephone rang in his office. A brisk, emphatic feminine voice asked for an appointment with Mr. Rourke, the architect. That afternoon a brisk, small, dark-skinned woman entered the office. She wore a mink coat and exotic earrings that tinkled when she moved her head. She moved her head a great deal in sharp little bird-like jerks. She was Mrs. Wayne Wilmot of Long Island, and she wished to build a country house. She had selected Mr. Rourke to build it, she explained, because he had designed the home of Austin Heller. She adored Austin Heller. He was, she stated, an oracle to all those pretending just the tiniest bit to the title of progressive intellectual, she thought. "Don't you?" And she followed Heller like a zealot. "Yes, literally, like a zealot." Mr. Rourke was very young, wasn't he? But she didn't mind that. She was very liberal and glad to help youth. She wanted a large house. She had 2 children. She believed in expressing their individuality. "Don't you?" And each had to have a separate nursery. She had to have a library. "I read to distraction. A music room, a conservatory. We grow lilies of the valley. My friends tell me it's my flower." A den for her husband, who trusted her implicitly and let her plan the house. "Because I'm so good at it. If I weren't a woman, I'm sure I'd be an architect." Servants' rooms and all that, and a 3-car garage. After an hour and a half of details and explanations, she said, "And, of course, as to the style of the house, it will be English Tudor. I adore English Tudor." He looked at her. He asked slowly,
"Have you seen Austin Heller's house?"
"No, though I did want to see it, but how could I? I've never met Mr. Heller. I'm only his fan, just that, a plain ordinary fan. What is he like in person? You must tell me. I'm dying to hear it." "No, I haven't seen his house. It's somewhere up in Maine, isn't it?"
Rourke took photographs out of the desk drawer and handed them to her.
"This," he said, "is the Heller house."
She looked at the photographs, her glance like water skimming off their glossy surfaces, and threw them down on the desk.
"Very interesting," she said. "Most unusual, quite stunning. But, of course, that's not what I want. That kind of a house wouldn't express my personality. My friends tell me I have the Elizabethan personality."
Quietly, patiently, he tried to explain to her why she should not build a Tudor house.
She interrupted him in the middle of a sentence.
"Look here, Mr. Rourke, you're not trying to teach me something, are you? I'm quite sure that I have good taste, and I know a great deal about architecture. I've taken a special course at the club. My friends tell me that I know more than many architects. I've quite made up my mind that I shall have an English Tudor house. I do not care to argue about it."
"You'll have to go to some other architect, Mrs. Wilmot."
She stared at him incredulously.
"You mean you're refusing the commission?"
"Yes."
"You don't want my commission?"
"No."
"But why?"
"I don't do this sort of thing."
"But I thought architects—"
"Yes. Architects will build you anything you ask for. Any other architect in town will."
"But I gave you first chance."
"Will you do me a favor, Mrs. Wilmot? Will you tell me why you came to me if all you wanted was a Tudor house?"
"Well, I certainly thought you'd appreciate the opportunity. And then I thought I could tell my friends that I had Austin Heller's architect."
He tried to explain and to convince. He knew while he spoke that it was useless, because his words sounded as if they were hitting a vacuum. There was no such person as Mrs. Wayne Wilmot. There was only a shell containing the opinions of her friends, the picture postcards she had seen, the novels of country squires she had read. It was this that he had to address, this immateriality which could not hear him or answer, deaf and impersonal like a wad of cotton.
"I'm sorry," said Mrs. Wayne Wilmot, "but I'm not accustomed to dealing with a person utterly incapable of reason. I'm quite sure I shall find plenty of bigger men who'll be glad to work for me. My husband was opposed to my idea of having you in the first place, and I'm sorry to see that he was right. Good day, Mr. Rourke."
She walked out with dignity, but she slammed the door. He slipped the photographs back into the drawer of his desk. Mr. Robert L. Mundy, who came to Rourke's office in March, had been sent by Austin Heller. Mr. Mundy's voice and hair were gray as steel, but his eyes were blue, gentle, and wistful. He wanted to build a house in Connecticut, and he spoke of it tremulously, like a young bridegroom, and like a man groping for his last secret goal. "It's not just a house, Mr. Rourke," he said with timid diffidence, as if he were speaking to a man older and more prominent than himself. "It's like a symbol to me. It's what I've been waiting and working for all these years. It's so many years now. I must tell you this so you'll understand. I have a great deal of money now, more than I care to think about. I didn't always have it. Maybe it came too late, I don't know. Young people think that you forget what happens on the way when you get there, but you don't. Something stays. I'll always remember how I was a boy, in a little place down in Georgia, that was, and how I ran errands for the harness maker, and the kids laughed when carriages drove by and splashed mud all over my pants. That's how long ago I decided that someday I'd have a house of my own, the kind of a house that carriages stopped before. After that, no matter how hard it got to be at times, I'd always think of that house, and it helped. Afterward, there were years when I was afraid of it. I could have built it, but I was afraid. Well, now the time has come. Do you understand, Mr. Rourke? Austin said you'd be just the man who'd understand."
"Yes," said Rourke eagerly. "I do."
"There was a place," said Mr. Mundy, "down there near my hometown, the mansion of the whole county, the Randolph place, an old plantation house, as they don't build them anymore. I used to deliver things there sometimes at the back door. That's the house I want, Mr. Rourke, just like it. But not back there in Georgia. I don't want to go back. Right here, near the city. I've bought the land. You must help me to have it landscaped, just like the Randolph place. We'll plant trees and shrubs, the kind they have in Georgia, the flowers and everything. We'll find a way to make them grow. I don't care how much it costs. Of course, we'll have electric lights and garages now, not carriages. But I want the electric lights made like candles. And I want the garages to look like the stables, everything just as it was. I have photographs of the Randolph place, and I've bought some of their old furniture."
When Rourke began to speak, Mr. Mundy listened in polite astonishment. He did not seem to resent the words. They did not penetrate.
"Don't you see?" Rourke was saying. "It's a monument you want to build, but not to yourself, not to your life or your own achievement, to other people, to their supremacy over you. You're not challenging that supremacy. You're immortalizing it. You haven't thrown it off. You're putting it up forever. Will you be happy if you seal yourself for the rest of your life in that borrowed shape? Or if you strike free for once and build a new house, your own? You don't want the Randolph place. You want what it stood for. But what it stood for is what you fought all your life.
Mr. Mundy listened blankly. And Rourke felt again a bewildered helplessness before unreality. There was no such person as Mr. Mundy. There were only the remnants, long dead, of the people who had inhabited the Randolph place. One could not plead with remnants or convince them.
No, said Mr. Mundy at last. No, you may be right, but that's not what I want at all. I don't say you haven't got your reasons, and they sound like good reasons. But I like the Randolph place.
Why?
Just because I like it. Just because that's what I like.
When Rourke told him that he would have to select another architect, Mr. Mundy said unexpectedly,
But I like you. Why can't you build it for me? What difference would it make to you?
Rourke did not explain. Later, Austin Heller said to him,
I expected it. I was afraid you'd turn him down. I'm not blaming you, Howard. Only he's so rich. It could have helped you so much.
And after all, you've got to live.
Not that way, said Rourke.
In April, Mr. Nathaniel Jantz, of the Jantz Stewart Real Estate Company, called Rourke to his office. Mr. Jantz was frank and blunt. He stated that his company was planning the erection of a small office building, 30 stories on Lower Broadway, and that he was not sold on Rourke as the architect. In fact, he was more or less opposed to him. But his friend Austin Heller had insisted that he should meet Rourke and talk to him about it. Mr. Jantz did not think very much of Rourke's stuff, but Heller had simply bullied him, and he would listen to Rourke before deciding on anyone. And what did Rourke have to say on the subject? Rourke had a great deal to say. He said it calmly, and this was difficult at first because he wanted that building, because what he felt was the desire to wrench that building out of Mr. Jantz at the point of a gun, if he'd had one. But after a few minutes it became simple and easy. The thought of the gun vanished, and even his desire for the building. It was not a commission to get, and he was not there to get it. He was only speaking of buildings. Mr. Jantz, when you buy an automobile, you don't want it to have rose garlands about the windows, a lion on each fender, and an angel sitting on the roof. Why don't you?
That would be silly, stated Mr. Jantz.
Why would it be silly? Now I think it would be beautiful. Besides, Louis XIV had a carriage like that, and what was good enough for Louis is good enough for us. We shouldn't go in for rash innovations, and we shouldn't break with tradition.
Now, you know damn well you don't believe anything of the sort.
I know I don't. But that's what you believe, isn't it? Now, take a human body. Why wouldn't you like to see a human body with a curling tail, with a crest of ostrich feathers at the end, and with ears shaped like acanthus leaves? It would be ornamental, you know, instead of the stark, bare ugliness we have now. Well, why don't you like the idea?
Because it would be useless and pointless. Because the beauty of the human body is that it hasn't a single muscle which doesn't serve its purpose, that there's not a line wasted, that every detail of it fits one idea, the idea of a man, and the life of a man. Will you tell me why, when it comes to a building, you don't want it to look as if it had any sense or purpose? You want to choke it with trimmings? You want to sacrifice its purpose to its envelope, not knowing even why you want that kind of an envelope? You want it to look like a hybrid beast produced by crossing the bastards of 10 different species until you get a creature without guts, without heart or brain, a creature all pelt, tail, claws, and feathers. Why? You must tell me, because I've never been able to understand it.
Well, said Mr. Jantz, I've never thought of it that way. He added, without great conviction, but we want our building to have dignity, you know, and beauty, what they call real beauty.
What who calls what beauty?
Well, tell me, Mr. Jantz, do you really think that Greek columns and fruit baskets are beautiful on a modern steel office building?
I don't know that I've ever thought anything about why a building was beautiful one way or another, Mr. Jantz confessed.
But I guess that's what the public wants.
Why do you suppose they want it?
I don't know.
Then why should you care what they want? You've got to consider the public.
Don't you know that most people take most things because that's what's given them, and they have no opinion whatever? Do you wish to be guided by what they expect you to think they think, or by your own judgment?
You can't force it down their throats.
You don't have to. You must only be patient.
because on your side you have reason. Oh, I know, it's something no one really wants to have on his side. And against you, you have just a vague, fat, blind inertia.
Why do you think that I don't want reason on my side?
It's not you, Mr. Jance. It's the way most people feel. They have to take a chance. Everything they do is taking a chance. But they feel so much safer when they take it on something they know to be ugly, vain, and stupid.
That's true, you know, said Mr. Jance.
At the conclusion of the interview, Mr. Jance said thoughtfully,
I can't say that it doesn't make sense, Mr. Rourke.
Let me think it over. You'll hear from me shortly. Mr. Jance called him a week later. It's the board of directors that will have to decide. Are you willing to try, Rourke? Draw up the plans and some preliminary sketches. I'll submit them to the board. I can't promise anything. But I'm for you, and I'll fight them on it. Rourke worked on the plans for 2 weeks of days and nights. The plans were submitted. Then he was called before the board of directors of the Jance Stewart Real Estate Company. He stood at the side of a long table, and he spoke, his eyes moving slowly from face to face. He tried not to look down at the table, but on the lower rim of his vision there remained the white spot of his drawings spread before the 12 men. He was asked a great many questions. Mr. Jance jumped up at times to answer instead, to pound the table with his fist, to snarl, Don't you see? Isn't it clear? What of it, Mr. Grant? What if no one has ever built anything like it? Gothic, Mr. Hubbard? Why must we have Gothic? I've a jolly good mind to resign if you turn this down. Rourke spoke quietly. He was the only man in the room who felt certain of his own words. He felt also that he had no hope. The 12 faces before him had a variety of countenances, but there was something, neither color nor feature, upon all of them as a common denominator, something that dissolved their expressions, so that they were not faces any longer, but only empty ovals of flesh. He was addressing everyone. He was addressing no one. He felt no answer, not even the echo of his own words striking against the membrane of an eardrum. His words were falling down a well, hitting stone salients on their way, and each salient refused to stop them, threw them farther, tossed them from one another, sent them to seek a bottom that did not exist. He was told that he would be informed of the board's decision. He knew that decision in advance. When he received the letter, he read it without feeling. The letter was from Mr. Jance, and it began, Dear Mr. Rourke, I'm sorry to inform you that our board of directors find themselves unable to grant you the commission for... There was a plea in the letter's brutal, offensive formality. The plea of a man who could not face him. John Fargo had started in life as a pushcart peddler. At 50, he owned a modest fortune and a prosperous department store on Lower 6th Avenue. For years he had fought successfully against a larger store across the street, one of many inherited by a numerous family. In the fall of last year, the family had moved that particular branch to new quarters farther uptown. They were convinced that the center of the city's retail business was shifting north, and they had decided to hasten the downfall of their former neighborhood by leaving their old store vacant, a grim reminder and embarrassment to their competitor across the street. John Fargo had answered by announcing that he would build a new store of his own on the very same spot, next door to his old one, a store newer and smarter than any the city had seen. He would, he declared, keep the prestige of his old neighborhood. When he called Rourke to his office, he did not say that he would have to decide later or think things over. He said, You're the architect. He sat, his feet on his desk, smoking a pipe, snapping out words and puffs of smoke together. I'll tell you what space I need and how much I want to spend. If you need more, say so. The rest is up to you. I don't know much about buildings, but I know a man who knows when I see him. Go ahead. Fargo had chosen Rourke because Fargo had driven one day past Gowan's service station and stopped and gone in and asked a few questions. After that, he bribed Heller's cook to show him through the house in Heller's absence. Fargo needed no further argument. Late in May, when the drafting table in Rourke's office was buried deep in sketches for the Fargo store, he received another commission.
Mr. Whitford Sanborn, the client, owned an office building that had been built for him many years ago by Henry Cameron. When Mr. Sanborn decided that he needed a new country residence, he rejected his wife's suggestions of other architects. He wrote to Henry Cameron. Cameron wrote a 10-page letter in answer. The first 3 lines of the letter stated that he had retired from practice. The rest of it was about Howard Rourke. Rourke never learned what had been said in that letter. Sanborn would not show it to him, and Cameron would not tell him. But Sanborn signed him to build the country residence, in spite of Mrs. Sanborn's violent objections. Mrs. Sanborn was the president of many charity organizations, and this had given her an addiction to autocracy such as no other avocation could develop. Mrs. Sanborn wished a French chateau built upon their new estate on the Hudson. She wished it to look stately and ancient, as if it had always belonged to the family. Of course, she admitted, people would know that it hadn't, but it would appear as if it had. Mr. Sanborn signed the contract after Rourke had explained to him in detail the kind of a house he was to expect. Mr. Sanborn had agreed to it readily, had not wished even to wait for sketches. "But of course, Fanny," Mr. Sanborn said wearily, "I want a modern house. I told you that long ago. That's what Cameron would have designed." "What in heaven's name does Cameron mean now?" she asked. "I don't know, Fanny. I know only that there's no building in New York like the one he did for me." The arguments continued for many long evenings in the dark, cluttered, polished mahogany splendor of the Sanborns' Victorian drawing-room. Mr. Sanborn wavered. Rourke asked, his arms sweeping out at the room around them, "Is this what you want?" "Well, if you're going to be impertinent," Mrs. Sanborn began, but Mr. Sanborn exploded. "Christ, Fanny, he's right. That's just what I don't want. That's just what I'm sick of." Rourke saw no one until his sketches were ready. The house, of plain field stone with great windows and many terraces, stood in the gardens over the river, as spacious as the spread of water, as open as the gardens. And one had to follow its lines attentively to find the exact steps by which it was tied to the sweep of the gardens. So gradual was the rise of the terraces, the approach to and the full reality of the walls. It seemed only that the trees flowed into the house and through it. It seemed that the house was not a barrier against sunlight, but a bowl to gather it, to concentrate it into brighter radiance than that of the air outside. Mr. Sanborn was first to see the sketches. He studied them, and then he said, "I don't know quite how to say it, Mr. Rourke. It's great. Cameron was right about you." After others had seen the sketches, Mr. Sanborn was not certain of this any longer. Mrs. Sanborn said that the house was awful, and the long evening arguments were resumed. "Now why can't we add turrets there on the corners?" Mrs. Sanborn asked. "There's plenty of room on those flat roofs." When she had been talked out of the turrets, she inquired, "Why can't we have mullioned windows? What difference would that make? God knows the windows are large enough, though why they have to be so large, I fail to see. It gives one no privacy at all. But I'm willing to accept your windows, Mr. Rourke, if you're so stubborn about it. But why can't you put mullions on the panes? It will soften things, and it gives a regal air, you know, a feudal sort of mood." The friends and relatives to whom Mrs. Sanborn hurried with the sketches did not like the house at all. Mrs. Walling called it preposterous, and Mrs. Hooper, crude. Mr. Melander said he wouldn't have it as a present. Mrs. Appleby stated that it looked like a shoe factory. Miss Davitt glanced at the sketches and said with approval, "Oh, how very artistic, my dear. Who designed it?" "Rourke? Rourke? Never heard of him." "Well, frankly, Fanny, it looks like something phony." The 2 children of the family were divided on the question. June Sanborn, aged 19, had always thought that all architects were romantic, and she had been delighted to learn that they would have a very young architect. But she did not like Rourke's appearance and his indifference to her hints. So she declared that the house was hideous, and she, for one, would refuse to live in it. Richard Sanborn, aged 24, who had been a brilliant student in college and was now slowly drinking himself to death, startled his family by emerging from his usual lethargy and declaring that the house was magnificent. No one could tell whether it was aesthetic appreciation or hatred of his mother, or both. Whitford Sanborn swayed with every new current. He would mutter, "Well now, not mullions, of course, that's utter rubbish, but couldn't you give her a cornice, Mr. Rourke, to keep peace in the family? Just a kind of crenellated cornice? It wouldn't spoil anything." Or would it? The arguments ended when Rourke declared that he would not build the house unless Mr. Sanborn approved the sketches just as they were and signed his approval on every sheet of the drawings. Mr. Sanborn signed. Mrs. Sanborn was pleased to learn shortly afterward that no reputable contractor would undertake the erection of the house. "You see," she started triumphantly. Mr. Sanborn refused to see. He found an obscure firm that accepted the commission grudgingly and as a special favor to him. Mrs. Sanborn learned that she had an ally in the contractor, and she broke social precedent to the extent of inviting him for tea. She had long since lost all coherent ideas about the house. She merely hated Rourke. Her contractor hated all architects, on principle. The construction of the Sanborn house proceeded through the months of summer and fall, each day bringing new battles. "But of course, Mr. Rourke, I told you I wanted three closets in my bedroom. I remember distinctly it was on a Friday, and we were sitting in the drawing-room, and Mr. Sanborn was sitting in the big chair by the window, and I was—" "What about the plans? What plans? How do you expect me to understand plans?" "Aunt Rosalie says she can't possibly climb a circular stairway, Mr. Rourke. What are we going to do? Select our guests to fit your house?" "Mr. Hulbert says that kind of a ceiling won't hold." "Oh, yes, Mr. Hulbert knows a lot about architecture. He's spent 2 summers in Venice." "June, poor darling, says her room will be dark as a cellar." "Well, that's the way she feels, Mr. Rourke. Even if it isn't dark, but if it makes her feel dark, it's the same thing." Rourke stayed up nights, redrafting the plans for the alterations which he could not avoid. It meant days of tearing down floors, stairways, partitions already erected. It meant extras piling up on the contractor's budget. The contractor shrugged and said, "I told you so. That's what always happens when you get one of those fancy architects. You wait and see what this thing will cost you before it gets through." Then, as the house took shape, it was Rourke who found that he wanted to make a change. The eastern wing had never quite satisfied him. Watching it rise, he saw the mistake he had made and the way to correct it. He knew it would bring the house into a more logical whole. He was making his first steps in building, and they were his first experiments. He could admit it openly. But Mr. Sanborn refused to allow the change. It was his turn. Rourke pleaded with him. Once the picture of that new wing had become clear in Rourke's mind, he could not bear to look at the house as it stood. "It's not that I disagree with you," Mr. Sanborn said coldly. "In fact, I do think you're right. But we cannot afford it." "Sorry. It will cost you less than the senseless changes Mrs. Sanborn has forced me to make. Don't bring that up again." "Mr. Sanborn," Rourke asked slowly, "will you sign a paper that you authorize this change, provided it costs you nothing?"
"Certainly, if you can conjure up a miracle to work that."
He signed. The eastern wing was rebuilt. Rourke paid for it himself. It cost him more than the fee he received. Mr. Sanborn hesitated. He wanted to repay it. Mrs. Sanborn stopped him. "It's just a low trick," she said. "Just a form of high pressure. He's blackmailing you on your better feelings. He expects you to pay. Wait and see, he'll ask for it. Don't let him get away with that."
Rourke did not ask for it. Mr. Sanborn never paid him.
When the house was completed, Mrs. Sanborn refused to live in it. Mr. Sanborn looked at it wistfully, too tired to admit that he loved it, that he had always wanted a home just like it. He surrendered. The house was not furnished. Mrs. Sanborn took herself, her husband, and her daughter off to Florida for the winter, where, she said, "We have a house that's a decent Spanish, thank God, because we bought it ready-made. This is what happens when you venture to build for yourself with some half-baked idiot of an architect." Her son, to everybody's amazement, exhibited a sudden burst of savage willpower. He refused to go to Florida. He liked the new house. He would live nowhere else. So 3 of the rooms were furnished for him. The family left, and he moved alone into the house on the Hudson. At night, one could see from the river a single rectangle of yellow, small and lost, among the windows of the huge dead house. The bulletin of the Architects Guild of America carried a small item. A curious incident, which would be amusing if it were not deplorable, is reported to us about a home recently built by Mr. Whitford Sanborn, noted industrialist. Designed by one Howard Rourke and erected at a cost of well over $100,000, this house was found by the family to be uninhabitable. It stands now abandoned as an eloquent witness to professional incompetence. Chapter 14. Lucius N. Heyer stubbornly refused to die. He had recovered from the stroke and returned to his office, ignoring the objections of his doctor and the solicitous protests of Guy Francone. Francone offered to buy him out. Heyer refused, his pale watering eyes staring obstinately at nothing at all. He came to his office every 2 or 3 days. He read the copies of correspondence left in his letter basket according to custom. He sat at his desk and drew flowers on a clean pad. Then he went home. He walked, dragging his feet slowly. He held his elbows pressed to his sides and his forearms thrust forward, with the fingers half closed, like claws. The fingers shook. He could not use his left hand at all. He would not retire. He liked to see his name on the firm's stationery. He wondered dimly why he was no longer introduced to prominent clients, why he never saw the sketches of their new buildings until they were half erected. If he mentioned this, Francone protested, "But, Lucius, I couldn't think of bothering you in your condition. Any other man would have retired long ago." Francone puzzled him mildly. Peter Keating baffled him. Keating barely bothered to greet him when they met, and then as an afterthought. Keating walked off in the middle of a sentence addressed to him. When Heyer issued some minor order to one of the draftsmen, it was not carried out, and the draftsman informed him that the order had been countermanded by Mr. Keating. Heyer could not understand it. He always remembered Keating as the diffident boy who had talked to him so nicely about old porcelain. He excused Keating at first. Then he tried to mollify him, humbly and clumsily. Then he conceived an unreasoning fear of Keating. He complained to Francone. He said petulantly, assuming the tone of an authority he could never have exercised, "That boy of yours, Guy, that Keating fellow, he's getting to be impossible. He's rude to me. You ought to get rid of him." "Now you see, Lucius," Francone answered dryly, "why I say that you should retire. You're overstraining your nerves, and you're beginning to imagine things." Then came the competition for the Cosmo Slotnick building. Cosmo Slotnick Pictures of Hollywood, California, had decided to erect a stupendous home office in New York, a skyscraper to house a motion picture theater and 40 floors of offices. A worldwide competition for the selection of the architect had been announced a year in advance. It was stated that Cosmo Slotnick were not merely the leaders in the art of the motion picture, but embraced all the arts, since all contributed to the creation of the films, and architecture being a lofty, though neglected branch of aesthetics, Cosmo Slotnick were ready to put it on the map. With the latest news of the casting of I'll Take a Sailor and the shooting of Wives for Sale came stories about the Parthenon and the Pantheon. Miss Sally O'Dawn was photographed on the steps of the Reims Cathedral in a bathing suit, and Mr. Pratt, Pardoner Purcell, gave an interview stating that he had always dreamed of being a master builder, if he hadn't been a movie actor. Ralston Holcomb, Guy Francone, and Gordon L. Prescott were quoted on the future of American architecture in an article written by Miss Dimples Williams, and an imaginary interview quoted what Sir Christopher Wren would have said about the motion picture. In the Sunday supplements, there were photographs of Cosmo Slotnick starlets in shorts and sweaters, holding T-squares and slide rules, standing before drawing boards that bore the legend Cosmo Slotnick Building over a huge question mark. The competition was open to all architects of all countries. The building was to rise on Broadway and to cost $10 million. It was to symbolize the genius of modern technology and the spirit of the American people. It was announced in advance as the most beautiful building in the world. The jury of award consisted of Mr. Shoup, representing Cosmo, Mr. Slotnick, representing Slotnick, Professor Peterkin of the Stanton Institute of Technology, the mayor of the city of New York, Ralston Holcomb, president of the AGA, and Ellsworth M. Toohey.
Go to it, Peter, Francone told Keating enthusiastically. Do your best. Give me all you've got. This is your great chance. You'll be known the world over if you win. And here's what we'll do. We'll put your name on our entry along with the firm's. If we win, you'll get 1/5 of the prize. The grand prize is $60,000, you know.
Hire will object, said Keating cautiously.
Let him object. That's why I'm doing it. He might get it through his head. What's the decent thing for him to do? And I...
Well, you know how I feel, Peter. I think of you as my partner already. I owe it to you. You've earned it. This might be your key to it.
Keating redrew his project 5 times. He hated it. He hated every girder of that building before it was born. He worked, his hand trembling. He did not think of the drawing under his hand. He thought of all the other contestants, of the man who might win and be proclaimed publicly as his superior. He wondered what that other one would do, how the other would solve the problem and surpass him. He had to beat that man. Nothing else mattered. There was no Peter Keating. There was only a suction chamber, like the kind of tropical plant he'd heard about, a plant that drew an insect into its vacuum and sucked it dry, and thus acquired its own substance. He felt nothing but immense uncertainty when his sketches were ready, and the delicate perspective of a white marble edifice lay neatly finished before him. It looked like a Renaissance palace made of rubber, and stretched to the height of 40 stories. He had chosen the style of the Renaissance because he knew the unwritten law that all architectural juries liked columns, and because he remembered Ralston Holcomb on the jury. He had borrowed from all of Holcomb's favorite Italian palaces. It looked good. It might be good. He was not sure. He had no one to ask. He heard these words in his own mind, and he felt a wave of blind fury. He felt it before he knew the reason, but he knew the reason almost in the same instant. There was someone whom he could ask. He did not want to think of that name. He would not go to him. The anger rose to his face, and he felt the hot, tight patches under his eyes. He knew that he would go. He pushed the thought out of his mind. He was not going anywhere. When the time came, he slipped his drawings into a folder and went to Rourke's office. He found Rourke alone, sitting at the desk in the large room that bore no signs of activity.
"Hello, Howard," he said brightly. "How are you?"
"I'm not interrupting anything, am I?"
"Hello, Peter," said Rourke. "You aren't."
"Not awfully busy, are you?"
"No."
"Mind if I sit down for a few minutes?"
"Sit down."
"Well, Howard, you've been doing great work. I've seen the Fargo store. It's splendid. My congratulations."
"Thank you."
"You've been forging straight ahead, haven't you? Had 3 commissions already?"
"4.
"Oh, yes, of course, 4. Pretty good. I hear you've been having a little trouble with the Sanborns."
"I have."
"Well, it's not all smooth sailing, not all of it, you know." "No new commissions since? Nothing?"
"No, nothing."
"Well, it will come. I've always said that architects don't have to cut one another's throat. There's plenty of work for all of us. We must develop a spirit of professional unity and cooperation. For instance, take that competition. Have you sent your entry in already?"
"What competition?"
"Why, the competition. The Kosmoslotnik competition."
"I'm not sending any entry."
"You're not? Not at all?"
"No."
"Why?"
"I don't enter competitions."
"Why, for heaven's sake?"
"Come on, Peter. You didn't come here to discuss that."
"As a matter of fact, I did think I'd show you my own entry. You understand I'm not asking you to help me. I just want your reaction. Just a general opinion." He hastened to open the folder. Rourke studied the sketches. Keating snapped. "Well, is it all right?"
"No, it's rotten. And you know it."
Then, for hours, while Keating watched and the sky darkened and lights flared up in the windows of the city, Rourke talked, explained, slashed lines through the plans, untangled the labyrinth of the theater's exits, cut windows, unraveled halls, smashed useless arches, straightened stairways. Keating stammered once, "Jesus, Howard, why don't you enter the competition if you can do it like this?"
Rourke answered, "Because I can't. I couldn't if I tried. I dry up, I go blank. I can't give them what they want. But I can straighten someone else's damn mess when I see it."
It was morning when he pushed the plans aside.
Keating whispered,
"And the elevation?"
"Oh, to hell with your elevation. I don't want to look at your damn Renaissance elevations."
But he looked. He could not prevent his hand from cutting lines across the perspective.
"All right, damn you. Give them good Renaissance, if you must, and if there is such a thing. Only I can't do that for you. Figure it out yourself. Something like this. Simpler, Peter, simpler, more direct, as honest as you can make of a dishonest thing. Now go home and try to work out something on this order."
Keating went home. He copied Rourke's plans. He worked out Rourke's hasty sketch of the elevation into a neat, finished perspective. Then the drawings were mailed, properly addressed, to the Most Beautiful Building in the World competition, Cosmo Slotnick Pictures Incorporated, New York City. The envelope accompanying the entry contained the names Frankonen Heyer, Architects, Peter Keating, Associated Designer. Through the months of that winter, Rourke found no other chances, no offers, no prospects of commissions. He sat at his desk and forgot at times to turn on the lights in the early dusk. It was as if the heavy immobility of all the hours that had flowed through the office, of its door, of its air, were beginning to seep into his muscles. He would rise and fling a book at the wall to feel his arm move, to hear the burst of sound. He smiled, amused, picked up the book and laid it neatly back on the desk. He turned on the desk lamp. Then he stopped before he had withdrawn his hands from the cone of light under the lamp, and he looked at his hands. He spread his fingers out slowly. Then he remembered what Cameron had said to him long ago. He jerked his hands away. He reached for his coat, turned the lights off, locked the door, and went home. As spring approached, he knew that his money would not last much longer. He paid the rent on his office promptly on the first of each month. He wanted the feeling of 30 days ahead, during which he would still own the office. He entered it calmly each morning. He found only that he did not want to look at the calendar when it began to grow dark, and he knew that another day of the 30 had gone. When he noticed this, he made himself look at the calendar. It was a race he was running now, a race between his rent money and... he did not know the name of the other contestant. Perhaps it was every man whom he passed on the street. When he went up to his office, the elevator operators looked at him in a queer, lazy, curious sort of way. When he spoke, they answered, not insolently, but in an indifferent drawl that seemed to say it would become insolent in a moment. They did not know what he was doing or why. They knew only that he was a man to whom no clients ever came. He attended, because Austin Heller asked him to attend, the few parties Heller gave occasionally. He was asked by guests, "Oh, you're an architect. You'll forgive me, I haven't kept up with architecture. What have you built?" When he answered, he heard them say, "Oh, yes, indeed." And he saw the conscious politeness of their manner tell him that he was an architect by presumption. They had never seen his buildings. They did not know whether his buildings were good or worthless. They knew only that they had never heard of these buildings. It was a war in which he was invited to fight nothing, yet he was pushed forward to fight. He had to fight. He had no choice. And no adversary. He passed by buildings under construction. He stopped to look at the steel cages. He felt at times as if the beams and girders were shaping themselves, not into a house, but into a barricade to stop him. And the few steps on the sidewalk that separated him from the wooden fence enclosing the construction were the steps he would never be able to take. It was pain, but it was a blunted, unpenetrating pain. "It's true," he would tell himself. "It's not," his body would answer. The strange, untouchable healthiness of his body. The Fargo store had opened, but one building could not save a neighborhood. Fargo's competitors had been right. The tide had turned, was flowing uptown. His customers were deserting him. Remarks were made openly on the decline of John Fargo, who had topped his poor business judgment by an investment in a preposterous kind of a building, which proved, it was stated, that the public would not accept these architectural innovations. It was not stated that the store was the cleanest and brightest in the city, that the skill of its plan made its operation easier than had ever been possible, that the neighborhood had been doomed before its erection. The building took the blame. Athelstan Beasley, the wit of the architectural profession, the court jester of the AGA, who never seemed to be building anything, but organized all the charity balls,
wrote in his column entitled Quips and Quirks in the AGA Bulletin. Well, lads and lassies, here's a fairy tale with a moral. Seems there was, once upon a time, a little boy with hair the color of a Halloween pumpkin who thought that he was better than all you common boys and girls. So to prove it, he up and built a house, which is a very nice house, except that nobody can live in it, and a store, which is a very lovely store, except that it's going bankrupt. He also erected a very eminent structure, to wit, a dog cart on a mud road. This last is reported to be doing very well indeed, which perhaps is the right field of endeavor for that little boy. At the end of March, Rourke read in the papers about Roger Enright. Roger Enright possessed millions, an oil concern, and no sense of restraint. This made his name appear in the papers frequently. He aroused a half-admiring, half-derisive awe by the incoherent variety of his sudden ventures. The latest was a project for a new type of residential development, an apartment building with each unit complete and isolated, like an expensive private home. It was to be known as the Enright House. Enright had declared that he did not want it to look like anything anywhere else. He had approached and rejected several of the best architects in town. Rourke felt as if this newspaper item were a personal invitation, the kind of chance created expressly for him. For the first time, he attempted to go after a commission. He requested an interview with Roger Enright. He got an interview with the secretary. The secretary, a young man who looked bored, asked him several questions about his experience. He asked them slowly, as if it required an effort to decide just what it would be appropriate to ask under the circumstances, since the answers would make no difference whatever. He glanced at some photographs of Rourke's buildings and declared that Mr. Enright would not be interested. In the first week of April, when Rourke had paid his last rental for one more month at the office, he was asked to submit drawings for the new building of the Manhattan Bank Company. He was asked by Mr. Widler, a member of the board of directors who was a friend of young Richard Sanborn. Widler told him, "I've had a stiff fight, Mr. Rourke, but I think I've won. I've taken them personally through the Sanborn house, and Dick and I explained a few things. However, the board must see the drawings before they make a decision, so it's not quite certain as yet, I must tell you frankly, but it's almost certain. They've turned down two other architects. They're very much interested in you. Go ahead. Good luck." Henry Cameron had had a relapse, and the doctor warned his sister that no recovery could be expected. She did not believe it. She felt a new hope, because she saw that Cameron, lying still in bed, looking serene and almost happy, a word she had never found it possible to associate with her brother. But she was frightened one evening when he said suddenly, "Call Howard. Ask him to come here." In the 3 years since his retirement, he had never called for Rourke. He had merely waited for Rourke's visits. Rourke arrived within an hour. He sat by the side of Cameron's bed, and Cameron talked to him as usual. He did not mention the special invitation, and did not explain. The night was warm, and the window of Cameron's bedroom stood open to the dark garden. When he noticed, in a pause between sentences, the silence of the trees outside, the unmoving silence of late hours, Cameron called his sister and said, "Fix the couch in the living room for Howard. He's staying here." Rourke looked at him and understood. Rourke inclined his head in agreement. He could acknowledge what Cameron had just declared to him only by a quiet glance as solemn as Cameron's. Rourke remained at the house for 3 days. No reference was made to his staying there, nor to how long he would have to stay. His presence was accepted as a natural fact, requiring no comment. Miss Cameron understood, and knew that she must say nothing. She moved about silently, with the meek courage of resignation. Cameron did not want Rourke's continuous presence in his room. He would say, "Go out, take a walk through the garden, Howard. It's beautiful. The grass is coming up." He would lie in bed and watch, with contentment through the open window, Rourke's figure moving among the bare trees that stood against a pale blue sky. He asked only that Rourke eat his meals with him. Miss Cameron would put a tray on Cameron's knees and serve Rourke's meal on a small table by the bed. Cameron seemed to take pleasure in what he had never had nor sought, a sense of warmth in performing a daily routine, the sense of family. On the evening of the third day, Cameron lay back on his pillow, talking as usual. But the words came slowly, and he did not move his head. Rourke listened, and concentrated on not showing that he knew what went on in the terrible pauses between Cameron's words. The words sounded natural, and the strain they cost was to remain Cameron's last secret, as he wished. Cameron spoke about the future of building materials.
Watch the light metals industry, Howard. In a few years, you'll see them do some astounding things. Watch the plastics. There's a whole new era coming from that. You'll find new tools, new means, new forms. You'll have to show the damn fools what wealth the human brain has made for them, what possibilities. Last week I read about a new kind of composition tile, and I've thought of a way to use it where nothing else would do. Take, for instance, a small house, about $5,000.
After a while he stopped and remained silent, his eyes closed. Then Rourke heard him whisper suddenly,
"Gail Winand."
Rourke leaned closer to him, bewildered.
"I don't hate anybody anymore. Only Gail Winand. No, I've never laid eyes on him. But he represents everything that's wrong with the world. The triumph of overbearing vulgarity. It's Gail Winand that you'll have to fight, Howard."
Then he did not speak for a long time. When he opened his eyes again, he smiled. He said,
"I know what you're going through at your office just now."
Rourke had never spoken to him of that.
"Now, don't deny, and don't say anything. I know, but it's all right. Don't be afraid. Do you remember the day when I tried to fire you? Forget what I said to you then. It was not the whole story. This is. Don't be afraid. It was worth it."
His voice failed, and he could not use it any longer. But the faculty of sight remained untouched, and he could lie silently and look at Rourke without effort. He died half an hour later. Keating saw Catherine often. He had not announced their engagement, but his mother knew, and it was not a precious secret of his own any longer. Catherine thought at times that he had dropped the sense of significance in their meetings. She was spared the loneliness of waiting for him, but she had lost the reassurance of his inevitable returns. Keating had told her, "Let's wait for the results of that movie competition, Katie. It won't be long. They'll announce the decision in May. If I win, I'll be set for life. Then we'll be married. And that's when I'll meet your uncle, and he'll want to meet me. And I've got to win. I know you'll win, because old Hire won't last another month. The doctor told us that we can expect a second stroke at any time, and that will be that. If it doesn't get him to the graveyard, it'll certainly get him out of the office."
"Oh, Peter, I don't like to hear you talk like that. You mustn't be so terribly selfish."
"I'm sorry, dear.
Well, yes, I guess I'm selfish. Everybody is."
He spent more time with Dominique. Dominique watched him complacently, as if he presented no further problem to her. She seemed to find him suitable as an inconsequential companion for an occasional inconsequential evening. He thought that she liked him. He knew that this was not an encouraging sign. He forgot at times that she was Francone's daughter. He forgot all the reasons that prompted him to want her. He felt no need to be prompted. He wanted her. He needed no reasons now but the excitement of her presence. Yet he felt helpless before her. He refused to accept the thought that a woman could remain indifferent to him. But he was not certain even of her indifference. He waited and tried to guess her moods, to respond as he supposed she wished him to respond. He received no answer. On a spring night, they attended a ball together. They danced, and he drew her close. He stressed the touch of his fingers on her body. He knew that she noticed and understood. She did not withdraw. She looked at him with an unmoving glance that was almost expectation. When they were leaving, he held her wrap and let his fingers rest on her shoulders. She did not move or draw the wrap closed. She waited. She let him lift his hands. Then they walked together down to the cab. She sat silently in a corner of the cab. She had never before considered his presence important enough to require silence. She sat, her legs crossed, her wrap gathered tightly, her fingertips beating in slow rotation against her knee. He closed his hand softly about her forearm. She did not resist. She did not answer. Only her fingers stopped beating. His lips touched her hair. It was not a kiss. He merely let his lips rest against her hair for a long time. When the cab stopped, he whispered, "Dominique, let me come up just for a moment." "Yes," she answered. The word was flat, impersonal, with no sound of invitation. But she had never allowed it before. He followed her, his heart pounding. There was one fragment of a second as she entered her apartment when she stopped, waiting. He stared at her helplessly, bewildered, too happy. He noticed a pause only when she was moving again, walking away from him into the drawing room. She sat down, and her hands fell limply, one at each side, her arms away from her body, leaving her unprotected. Her eyes were half closed, rectangular, empty. "Dominique," he whispered. "Dominique, how lovely you are." Then he was beside her, whispering incoherently, "Dominique, Dominique, I love you. Don't laugh at me, please don't laugh. My whole life, anything you wish, don't you know how beautiful you are? Dominique, I love you." He stopped with his arms around her and his face over hers to catch some hint of response or resistance. He saw nothing. He jerked her violently against him and kissed her lips. His arms fell open. He let her body fall back against the seat, and he stared at her, aghast. It had not been a kiss. He had not held a woman in his arms. What he had held and kissed had not been alive. Her lips had not moved in answer against his. Her arms had not moved to embrace him. It was not revulsion. He could have understood revulsion. It was as if he could hold her forever or drop her, kiss her again or go further to satisfy his desire. And her body would not know it, would not notice it. She was looking at him, past him. She saw a cigarette stub that had fallen off a tray on a table beside her. She moved her hand and slipped the cigarette back into the tray. "Dominique," he whispered stupidly. "Didn't you want me to kiss you?" "Yes." She was not laughing at him. She was answering simply and helplessly. "Haven't you ever been kissed before?" "Yes, many times." "Do you always act like that?" "Always, just like that." "Why did you want me to kiss you?" "I wanted to try it." "You're not human, Dominique." She lifted her head, she got up, and the sharp precision of the movement was her own again. He knew he would hear no simple, confessing helplessness in her voice. He knew the intimacy was ended. Even though her words, when she spoke, were more intimate and revealing than anything she had said, but she spoke as if she did not care what she revealed or to whom. "I suppose I'm one of those freaks you hear about, an utterly frigid woman. I'm sorry, Peter. You see, you have no rivals, but that includes you also." "A disappointment, darling?" "You'll outgrow it. Someday." "I'm really not so young, Peter. 25. It must be an interesting experience to sleep with a man. I've wanted to want it. I should think it would be exciting to become a dissolute woman. I am, you know, in everything but in fact." "Peter, you look as if you were going to blush in a moment, and that's very amusing. Dominique, haven't you ever been in love at all? Not even a little?" "I haven't. I really wanted to fall in love with you. I thought it would be convenient. I'd have no trouble with you at all. But you see, I can't feel anything. I can't feel any difference, whether it's you or Alva Skerritt or Lucius Heyer." He got up. He did not want to look at her. He walked to a window and stood staring out, his hands clasped behind his back. He had forgotten his desire and her beauty. But he remembered now that she was Francone's daughter. "Dominique, will you marry me?" He knew he had to say it now. If he let himself think of her, he would never say it. What he felt for her did not matter any longer. He could not let it stand between him and his future. And what he felt for her was growing into hatred.
"You're not serious," she asked.
He turned to her. He spoke rapidly, easily. He was lying now, and so he was sure of himself, and it was not difficult. "I love you, Dominique. I'm crazy about you. Give me a chance. If there's no one else, why not? You'll learn to love me, because I understand you. I'll be patient. I'll make you happy." She shuddered suddenly, and then she laughed. She laughed simply, completely. He saw the pale foam of her dress trembling. She stood straight, her head thrown back, like a string shaking with the vibrations of a blinding insult to him. An insult, because her laughter was not bitter or mocking, but quite simply gay. Then it stopped. She stood looking at him. She said earnestly, "Peter, if I ever want to punish myself for something terrible, if I ever want to punish myself disgustingly, I'll marry you." She added, "Consider it a promise. I'll wait, no matter what reason you choose for it." Then she smiled gaily, the cold, gay smile he dreaded. "Really, Peter, you don't have to do it, you know. You'll get that partnership anyway. And we'll always be good friends. Now it's time for you to go home. Don't forget you're taking me to the horse show Wednesday." "Oh, yes, we're going to the horse show Wednesday. I adore horse shows." "Good night, Peter." He left and walked home through the warm spring night. He walked savagely. If at that moment someone had offered him sole ownership of the firm of Francone and Hire at the price of marrying Dominique, he would have refused it. He knew also, hating himself, that he would not refuse if it were offered to him on the following morning. Chapter 15. This was fear. This was what one feels in nightmares, thought Peter Keating. Only then one awakes when it becomes unbearable, but he could neither awaken nor bear it any longer. It had been growing for days, for weeks, and now it had caught him, this lewd, unspeakable dread of defeat. He would lose the competition. He was certain that he would lose it, and the certainty grew as each day of waiting passed. He could not work. He jerked when people spoke to him. He had not slept for nights. He walked toward the house of Lucius Hire. He tried not to notice the faces of the people he passed, but he had to notice. He had always looked at people, and people looked at him as they always did. He wanted to shout at them and tell them to turn away, to leave him alone. They were staring at him, he thought, because he was to fail, and they knew it. He was going to Hire's house to save himself from the coming disaster in the only way he saw left to him. If he failed in that competition, and he knew he was to fail, Francone would be shocked and disillusioned. Then if Hire died, as he could die at any moment, Francone would hesitate, in the bitter aftermath of a public humiliation, to accept Keating as his partner. If Francone hesitated, the game was lost. There were others waiting for the opportunity. Bennett, whom he had been unable to get out of the office, Claude Stengel, who had been doing very well on his own, and had approached Francone with an offer to buy Hire's place. Keating had nothing to count on except Francone's uncertain faith in him. Once another partner replaced Hire, it would be the end of Keating's future. He had come